Okay, never mind. Now, the thing that most people don't realize is that once you experience a jhana one time in your life, you can experience nibbana at any other time during your life. A lot of people have this idea that jhana is only while you're sitting. And like last week, I tried to explain that's not true. You can have jhana with you all the time. Now, that means that you have to have exceptional mindfulness and catch yourself just thinking nonsense thoughts. It's important that you gain the confidence in being able to go into a jhana experience at any time that you want. And nibbana can happen at any time. I've had a student that was washing dishes and she felt her mind going very deep and she stopped and sat down and experienced nibbana. That can happen. Nibbana is an experience of opening up your mind and experiencing the joy, the happiness, and the unification of mind. You can have this experience at any time. And it's important for you to understand that it does take practice. And the more you practice, the easier and more confidence you have in staying with this joyful feeling and this peaceful, calm feeling and the equanimity. So, thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Kampa on the banks of the Gagara Lake with a large sangha of monks. Then Pissa, excuse me, the elephant driver's son, and Kandaraka, the wanderer, went to the Blessed One. Pissa, after paying homage to the Blessed One, sat down at one side while Kandaraga exchanged greetings with the Blessed One. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. Standing there, he surveyed the sangha of monks sitting in complete silence. And then he said to the Blessed One, "It is wonderful, Master Gotama, it is marvelous how the Sangha of monks have been led to practice the right way by Master Gotama. Those who were blessed ones accomplished fully awakened in the past, at most only led the Sangha of monks to practice the right way as it is done by Master Gotama now. And those will be blessed ones, accomplished and fully awakened in the future, at most only led by the Sangha of monks to practice the right way as done by Master Gotama now." So it is, Kangaraka. So it is. Those who were blessed ones, accomplished and fully awakened in the past, at most only led the Sangha of monks to practice the right way, as is done by me now. And those who will be blessed ones, accomplished and fully awakened in the future, at most will only lead the Sangha of monks to practice the right way, as is done by me now. In this Sangha of monks, there are monks who are arahats with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, that means destroyed craving, and who are completely liberated through final knowledge. In this Sangha of monks, there are monks in higher training, constant virtue, living a life of constant virtue, sagacious, living a life of constant sagacity. They abide with a mind well established in the four foundations of mindfulness. What for? Here a monk abides observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, mindful, and having put away covetous and grief for the world. He abides observing, feeling as feeling, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And this is something that a lot of people, this is part of the Satipatthana Sutta, and an awful lot of people have this as putting away covetous and grief for the world as just a statement to be gone over, but not thought about deeply. Putting away covetousness and grief for the world means that they have very, very little craving left in their mind. They've used the six R's, and they become have become anagamis, the third stage of awakening. Now, putting away covetousness and grief for the world means letting go of these hindrances that keep distracting the mind and causing all kinds of problems. This is one of the things that I was talking to you about last week, about carrying your meditation with you all day. Catch yourself when you start to get emotional likes and dislikes that cause your mind to go into suffering a lot. Develop having equanimity, no matter what the cause of the situation comes up. It takes strong mindfulness to be able to do that. It takes strong observation and remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. In the early part of the day, you can have a very happy mind. And then all of a sudden something comes up and it's something you don't like and you get into an emotional thing with it. What are you supposed to do? indulge in that emotional upset and cause yourself more and more suffering and suffering to those around you? Or are you going to use your six R's and your forgiveness and your gratitude for things that come up? A lot of people are taught that hindrances are something that you're supposed to fight with and you're supposed to suppress. And the more you fight with it, the more you suppress it, the bigger and more intense that emotional upset becomes. Where is your equanimity? Where is your balance of mind so that you can see things clearly without getting caught in the I like it, I don't like it syndrome? It's really kind of amazing when you start studying dependent origination and you start seeing this as a process rather than something personal that you have to get involved with. So, when this was said, Pessa, the elephant driver's son, said, "It is wonderful, venerable sir, it is marvelous." I always love it when that marvelous comes into comes into the scripture, because that's my actual name, Marvel. So it makes me happy every time I see it. How well the four foundations of mindfulness have been made known by the Blessed One for the purification of beings, for surmounting sorrow, lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of a true way, for the realization of Nibbana. From time to time, venerable sir, we white-clothed lay people also abide with our minds well established in these four foundations of mindfulness. Here, venerable sir, we abide observing the body as a body, feeling as feeling, mind as mind, and mind objects as mind objects. Ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. It is wonderful, venerable sir, it is marvelous how amid man's tangled corruptions and deceptions, the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings. For humankind is a tangled, but animal is open enough. Venerable sir, I drive an elephant to be tamed, and in the time it takes to make a trip back and forth in Kampa, that elephant will show every kind of deception, duplicity, crookedness, and fraud. But those who are called our slaves, messengers, and servants behave in one way with the body, in another way with speech, while their minds work in still another way. It is wonderful, venerable sir, it is marvelous how amid man's tangled corruptions and deception, the Blessed One knows the welfare and harm of beings. For humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. So it is, Pessa, so it is. Humankind is a tangle, but the animal is open enough. Tessa, there are four kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What for? Here, a certain kind of person torments itself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. Does that sound familiar for most of us? How we torture ourselves because we get so involved in our thinking and liking and disliking without any mindfulness at all. Here, a certain person torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Here, a certain kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself, and he also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others. Here, a certain kind of person does not torment himself or pursue the practice of torturing himself and does not torment others or pursue the practice of torturing others. Since he torments neither himself nor others, he is here and now, hungerless, extinguished, and cooled, and he abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. Now, what are we talking about here? When you get into a jhana, you don't wind up torturing yourself or torturing others. You don't get angry with yourself or get angry with others. You spend time having gratitude for another person's opinion, even if you don't agree with it. You don't take it personally. You stay in the jhana with that equanimity and balance of mind. Now, this is a complete change of perspective. And it's real important for you to understand that you need to have this change of perspective instead of always going back to the way I used to do it and wind up causing pain for yourself and pain for others. Which of these four kinds of persons satisfies your mind, Pessa? The first three do not satisfy my mind, Venerable Sir, but the last one satisfies my mind. But Pessa, why don't the first three kinds of persons satisfy your mind, Venerable Sir? The kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself, torments and tortures himself through the desires, pleasures, and recoils from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the kind of person who torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others, torments and tortures others who desire pleasure and recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. And the kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself and also torments others and pursues the practice of torturing others, torments and tortures himself and others, both of who desire pleasure and recoil from pain. That is why this kind of person does not satisfy my mind. But the kind of person who does not torment himself and pursue the practice of tormenting himself, how many times during a retreat do I tell people, be kind to yourself? There are going to be times when you're going to make a mistake. That doesn't mean that that opens up the door for you to criticize yourself, get angry with yourself, and keep thinking about that mistake and how you wish you hadn't have done it. This practice teaches you how to change your perspective so you can be accepting of making a mistake. But if you're going to make a mistake, just make it once. Don't make the same mistake over and over again. I've had students that tell me at the end of the retreat, now I can let go of the precepts and get back to the way that I was before. And this is not learning anything from the meditation. You're not teaching yourself how to change. You're attached to your perspective. You're attached to the excitement of emotional upset. And you cause suffering not only to yourself, but to others. This is really important to understand, that when you're practicing jhana practice, you don't have any hindrances arising. Keeping your mindfulness going. Watch how your mind changes and jumps from one thing to another. Of course, it doesn't jump all at one time. There is a process that happens. Now, when I give you the instructions on the six R's, I generally just start at feeling. Because feeling is either pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. And it's okay for the feeling to be there. It has to be okay because that's the truth. It is, when it arises, it's there. And right after that feeling is where craving arises. I like it or I don't like it. And that's the beginning of the identification. This is me. This is mine. This is who I am. And then you get into your opinions and all kinds of ideas that you think is right and everybody else is wrong, and you'll get into arguments and fights with that. Is it really worth that? Is it really worth to get into your dislike of someone else because they have an opinion that you don't agree with? Or can you accept them, and you have to be able to agree to disagree without emotional upsets? And watch what your mind does right after that. That's when your mindfulness needs to take off and really be alert, because you'll wind up spending an awful long time repeating thoughts over and over again. I like this, I don't like that. This person said this and I don't agree with it. And how stupid are they? And how you get involved in your judgments. And is it really that important? Is it really that important that you are right and somebody else is wrong? When you have good equanimity, you can accept that other person is having a very peculiar view of things, But it's okay for them to have that view. It has to be okay because it's theirs. And they can do whatever they want with it. Keeping a sense of equanimity going all the time. That leads to a happy mind. Having gratitude that you made a mistake so you can see that you don't need to do that again. Not fight with a mistake and criticize yourself and have all kinds of repeat thoughts about how you made a mistake and how you blew it. This is really important for you to understand that equanimity is the way that leads to Nibbana. It's a way that leads to a happy, uplifted mind. And the more you practice it with your daily activities and with your own private thoughts and feelings. I've heard it said that if you want to change a habit, it takes 30 days to change an old habit into a new habit. But it takes 30 days of work, of improving your mindfulness, catching yourself, and letting go of that craving. Using the six R's. Too many people have the idea that using the six R is going to block the pain. It's not like that. It's not for that. It's not to make changes happen in you. It's not to suppress things that you don't like. It's only to let go of the craving so you can see for yourself and teach yourself how that habit actually works. And when you see that, and when you use the six R's without the expectation that it's going to make something different, it doesn't. It helps take away that false belief in a personal self that causes so much suffering. Now, I've had some people that have been quite successful with their meditation. And one day they got into some kind of emotional upset. And they came to me and they said, "This doesn't work." I said, "Yes, it does. Every time it works, it doesn't work the way you expect it to work. But it does work. But I release and relax and release and relax and release and relax, and it still doesn't make this problem go away." Well, of course it's not going to do that. It's not supposed to do that. Who wants to control it? Who wants to make this be different than it actually is? Who really gets involved in that false belief in a personal self, the pain of that being like that, and not developing their acceptance, their gratitude for this problem coming up so that they can learn how it works and how their attachment keeps causing more and more suffering? It's not going to make the suffering stop. It's not going to make the suffering go away. The suffering will go away by itself as you stop making a big deal out of whatever this problem is. You see that? I hope you do. This is important. So many times when I was practicing the first 20 years of my practice, when hindrances would come up, sometimes those hindrances would stay for a long time. And then they'd kind of go away by themselves for a little while, and then they'd pop up again. I never learned how to let go of that attachment. And the attachment was the craving and the false belief that this was me personally. When you're in a jhana, you don't have these kind of hindrances arising anymore when you're in the jhana. So why don't you get into a jhana? I don't care which one. I generally was waiting for people to become very successful with their meditation before I started teaching mastery of the jhanas. But there is a way that you can do this even after you experience the first jhana, or the second jhana, or the third jhana. You sit for a period of time, and you get into, let's say, the first jhana. And you stay in that jhana for 10 minutes. And then you come out of that jhana. And when you come out, you try to hit it at exactly 10 minutes, or 9 minutes and 59 seconds, or 10 minutes and 5 seconds. Make it a time that you can go into that first jhana, be there for that period of time, and come out at exactly that time. And you do this over and over again until you start noticing differences about the jhana that you'd never noticed before. You start seeing more clearly what the jhana actually is and how it works. When you're able to hit, say, the 10-minute mark, whatever it happens to be, 9:55 or 10:05, when you can hit that, let's say 5 times in a row, then you extend the time that you're sitting in the jhana, say around 30 minutes. So you go into the jhana, you're in that jhana for 25 seconds, and you come out, going in and out, developing that jhana and staying with that period of time until you can hit it 5 times in a row. Then you extend the time to an hour. And when you can go in and out of that at exactly the right time, in and out, you have mastered going in and out of the first jhana. Now carry that with you, with your daily activities, and see that your mind is starting to get upset about this or that, and you lose your mindfulness. Then slip into the jhana for 10 minutes, if it's appropriate, or a half an hour if you have the time. And start using going in and out of the jhana with your daily activities. you start gaining more and more confidence. And the ability to go in and out of that jhana, and that starts to change your perspective because you're starting to learn more and more about the jhana itself. Now remember, jhana is a level of understanding. You are teaching yourself how to go in and out of that jhana and gain more confidence in yourself, and that will start changing your personality because your mind is pure at that time. Your mind is very alert at that time. It doesn't mean that you can't be doing other tasks too. You can be. But as you become more and more familiar with being in the first jhana, it will start happening more and more by itself. And this is a very good thing. And as you start learning more and more about how your mind works, you start affecting people around you in a positive way, and you stop torturing them, whether it's intentional or unintentional. You start to become an example of someone that has an uplifted mind. People will begin to appreciate you more and more. This is how developing mastery of going in and out of a jhana is very helpful. Now, when I was going to the hospital, I used to like to get into the second jhana because the joy was more, it was stronger. And people really started understanding that they can have an uplifted mind even if they have pain. The pain starts to become less and less intense. So it's a very, and I also like getting into the third jhana where there was still a happy feeling, but there was also strong equanimity, acceptance, not fighting what was happening in the present, accepting what was happening in the present. Okay. And now, venerable sir, we must depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Pessa. Do as you think fit. Then Pessa, the elephant driver's son, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on the right. He departed. Soon after he left, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Pessa, the elephant driver's son, is wise. He has great wisdom. If he had sat a while longer until I expounded for him the detail of the four kinds of persons, he would have greatly benefited. Still, he has already greatly benefited, even as it is. This is the time, Blessed One. This is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to expound in detailed meaning the four kinds of persons. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the monks will remember it. Then, monks, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, venerable sir." The monks replied, the Blessed One said this, monks, what kind of person torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself? Here a certain person goes naked, rejecting conventions, licking his hands, not coming when asked, not stopping when asked. He does not accept food that's brought or food especially made for an invitation to a meal. He receives nothing from a pot, from a bowl, across a threshold. These are all ascetic practices that the Buddha is talking about here. And the licking of the hands is really something. I've been in India when they start licking their hands, and their hands are exceptionally dirty. And they lick it from the wrist all the way up through the fingers. It's really disgusting looking. Anyway, from two people eating together, from a pregnant woman, from a woman giving suck, from a woman lying with a man, from where food is advertised to be distributed, from where a dog is waiting, from where flies are buzzing. It's hard to find places in Asia that the flies are not buzzing. He accepts no fish or meat. He drinks no liquor, wine, or fermented brew. He keeps to one house, one morsel. He keeps to two houses, two morsels. And he goes all the way up to seven houses and seven morsels. He lives on one saucer full of food a day, on two saucerfuls of a day, all the way up to seven saucerfuls a day. He takes food once a day, once every 2 days, once every 7 days. So too up to every fortnight. I ran across a monk that did that. He would not take any food for up to 14 days. And then he would stuff himself. He would start eating food and he would just overeat. And that dulled his mind. I asked him why he did that. He said, well, when I don't eat, I don't have lust arising. Of course he did. He had lust for the food. He was thinking about food all the time. But he didn't recognize that as a hindrance. Not a practice that I really endorse, I'll say that for sure. He's an eater of greens or millet or wild rice, or hide parings, or moss, or rice bran, or rice scum, or sesame, or grass, or cow dung. That's one of the ascetic practices, eating cow dung and drinking cow's urine. Monks have certain remedies if they get if they get sick and have some kind of skin disease or some kind of disease that's really hard on the body. And one of the remedies in the Vinaya is that they go out and get cow's urine and they put it in a jug or a bottle that's closed up for 7 days out in the sun. And then They start drinking the cow's urine. I was sick at one time when I was a monk, a young monk, and one of the old teachers told me that I could do that. So I thought, well, that sounds disgusting, but I'll try it just to see what happens. The taste of the urine is almost nothing, but the smell of the urine, nobody came to visit me after I started doing this. I did it for about a week. But it also healed my body very quickly. So I've tried it. I know it works. If you have a COVID-19, try some cow urine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm only kidding. I'm not a doctor. Don't take me. But you're a bunch of city folks, so you're not around cows enough to notice that sort of thing. Okay, he lives in a forest, roots and fruits. He feeds on fallen fruit. He clothes himself with hemp, in hemp-mixed cloth, in shrouds, in refuge rags. The refuge rags are rags that are at the charnel ground, and they wrap bodies in it. And if nobody comes to pick up the body and take care of it and cremate it, then that cloth is just kind of hangs around, and the monks could use that cloth as robes. Now, this is an ascetic practice. It's not what the Buddhist monks did. They also would dress in tree bark, in antelope hide, in strips of antelope hide, in kusa grass fabric. Now, kusa grass is really nasty. You know what paper cut is like? That's like almost as sharp as kusa grass. And they would weave this kusa grass, and when they started walking, they would have cuts all over their legs and back. Kusa grass is not a desirable thing to be messing with. This is where the word kusala comes from. Kusala means wholesome. Akusala means unwholesome. You have to be very attentive not to get cut by kusa grass if you're handling it. So that means that you have to be very sharp mindfulness so that you don't cut your fingers up. Wood shaving fabrics, in head hair wool, in animal wool, in owl's wings. He is one who pulls out hair and beard, pursuing the practice of pulling out hair and beard. They had tweezers and they would pull their hair out instead of cut it. That's an ascetic practice. It's very, very difficult. He is one who stands continuously rejecting chairs. He is one who squats continuously, devoted to maintaining the squatting position. He is one who uses mattresses of spikes. He makes a mattress of spikes for his bed. He dwells pursuing the practice of bathing in water three times daily, including the evening. The Asians don't like to get wet in the evening because they say they'll catch a cold. And they're quite often they do catch a cold if they're getting their body immersed in water. Thus is some of the right of ways he dwells, pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. This is called a kind of person who torments himself and pursues the practice of torturing himself. That sounds a lot different than what I was just talking about with tormenting yourself. You can do it physically, like this is talking about. You can torment yourself and have all kinds of problems. Or mentally. Now, I tend towards talking about the mental torture that we have for ourselves. One of the things with breaking a precept is we wind up with remorse. We wind up telling ourselves we shouldn't have done that. And then we get angry at ourselves. And then we have all kinds of repeat thoughts about that. Until finally you kind of forget it until another situation that comes up that's similar. And then you have the old torture that you did to yourself. And then you add on some more torture. So you really become highly involved in that identification and that craving that causes so much suffering. So spending time accepting the fact that you make mistakes and you have anger, and you use that anger to not only cause yourself problems, but cause problems to other people. You have to learn that this is the cause of your suffering, and you're causing suffering to other people because of your attachment to it. What kind of person torments others and pursues the practice of tormenting other? Here a certain person is a butcher of sheep, a butcher of pigs, a fowler, a trapper of wild beasts, a hunter, a fisherman, a thief, an executioner, a prison warden, or one who follows any other such bloody occupations. I always get a kick out of being with people that say that they're vegetarian. I only eat meat. I only eat vegetables, but I also eat fish. And fishing is one of the most cruel activities that I've ever run across. When I was a young kid, I went with my father or my grandfather to go fishing. And he caught a fish and he pulled it out of the water, and the fish was on dry land. And I got so disgusted and upset just watching that fish try to breathe before he died. And how they get caught on a hook. So you have something pulling in your mouth and you try to get away and you get pulled back. Now this is called sport. I can't imagine that being a real sport. Now we're going to get into vegetarianism. And I eat meat. My body is a kind of body that needs to have that kind of nourishment in it. I've had it tested. I know that this is, I'm not supposed to be a vegetarian. And I get criticized for eating meat. How can he be a spiritual person when so many beings die because he has to eat meat? Well, there are five different criteria for killing. One, the being has to be alive. There has to be intention to kill it. There is a weapon. A weapon is used and the being dies. That is the definition of killing. Because I'm a monk, I don't really go into the store looking for things to eat. Other people do that. When they go to the meat counter, one, is that being alive? Not was it alive, is it alive? No. Is there intention to kill that being? No. There's no intention to kill it. Is a weapon used? Or is there a weapon? Is that weapon used? And does the being die? None of those criteria for killing exist with a piece of flesh that's on the counter. And there's always these people that say, but you're supporting it. I'm not supporting anything. I'm using food to keep my energy up so I can keep practicing. I can't go without food. I've tried that. I did a 30-day fast. Doesn't work so good. So the question of whether I'm supposed to be a vegetarian or not, that mostly came from the Chinese. And the reason it came from the Chinese was because they didn't have a whole lot of food. And there was a lot of people to be fed. So they were going out and foraging. And the big landowners back in, when was it, the Song Dynasty? About 3,000 years ago. Anyway, they found out that if they took soybean and put it in their fields, that it would help the next crop and they would be healthy and it would be good food. And there was a famine that happened when they put all of this in the soil. And these soybeans, the Chinese, the peasants, decided that they had to learn how to eat it. Now, if you know anything about soybeans, they are hard little rocks, the seeds. And it takes a special kind of process to turn it into soybean or soy. And the only reason that they were using that was because there wasn't any other food around. And it had been a fast and it had been a famine for a period of time. They had to find something to eat. So over the years, they started using soybean because it had some protein in it and they could exist as long as they ate it with some other vegetables and such. But there's a problem with soy. And that is there's a couple of enzymes in the soy itself that are really bad for your body and cause all kinds of problems. So if you use that as your only source of protein, then you have run into a health problems because of that. Anyway, to get back to the whole idea of not killing or harming a living being, I don't have anything to do with that. I don't kill and harm living beings. I let even nasty little beings go free. I take them out. If they get in my cabin, I take them outside and let them go free. Wasps, some forms of ants that really have big bites. And I live in the forest. Of course, there's going to be those kind of beings around. But I don't kill them on purpose. I don't take anything that's not given. I don't have any sexual activity, so I have no wrong sexual activity. The speech is used not to deceive other people. That's what lying is, trying to deceive other people. I don't try to divide groups from one thing from another. I don't use harsh language. And I certainly don't gossip. And I don't take any drugs and alcohol, although I do take a lot of medicines. So I would like for you to be more and more serious about keeping your precepts, about developing your mindfulness so that you have the ability to go into a jhana at the blink of an eye. And with that, you will have a different take with your personality development. And it's a very necessary part of the practice. So I've been talking for even longer than I should have been. And I've only gotten through part of the sutta. We'll try it again next week. Then let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I hope everybody has a happy or a merry Christmas, and I'll see you next week. Okay?
Thank you very much, Bhante.
Okay.
Thank you, Bhante.
Keep your mindfulness going.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Bhante.
Okay.